Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm going to be reading articles that were published by the Geographic Society in March of 2024. I hope you enjoy the program. We'll begin with this article titled, Spring Cleaning Has Ancient Origins. Here's why we still do it. While the specific customs and practices may vary across cultures, the underlying themes of purification, preparation for new beginnings, and the celebration of spring's arrival remain central to this enduring tradition. It's written by Lola Mendez. As the Northern Hemisphere ushers in the new season, a contagious urge to dust off cobwebs and toss out cluster emerges. Spring cleaning, a deep cleanse of one's home, is a tradition ingrained in societies worldwide, with roots tracing back to ancient times. It also holds symbolic significance. Viewed as a fresh start, the tradition symbolizes the transition from the dormant winter season to the vibrant growth of spring. By purging the home of accumulated debris and organizing its contents, individuals create a cleaner living environment and a sense of mental clarity and freshness. With each sweep of the broom and polish of the surface, we honor a tradition that transcends time, uniting us with generations past in a shared pursuit of renewal and rejuvenation, says Danielle Patton, Director of Creative Programs and Collections at the Museum of the Home in London. The benefits of spring cleaning. Human behavior is greatly influenced by the cycles of nature. In the colder months, we have less energy to spare for chores such as deep cleaning. We're not being lazy. Limited daylight triggers the hormone melatonin, which makes us sleepy. Melatonin causes us to feel less inclined to refresh our space. When the seasons start to shift, feelings of sluggishness reduce, and we regain energy and feel inspired to deep clean our living environments, says author and psychotherapist Eloise Skinner. When we refresh our environments, we can feel a sense of a new beginning or a renewed sense of drive and ambition. Studies have also shown that cleaning can be therapeutic, as seen by the new generation of cleanfluencers taking social media by storm. Millions of people watch them scour filthy homes and dole out cleaning hacks. When we're cleaning, we often have to be present to the task at hand, and this can bring us into the present moment, causing us to feel more aware, engaged, and observant. The repetitive nature can also be soothing, Skinner says. Religious and cultural origins. One of the earliest known references to spring cleaning is found in the Jewish tradition of Passover, which is observed annually in March or April. People remove all traces of shamats, or leavened bread, which is prohibited leading up to the holiday. Its removal symbolizes the haste with which the Israelites fled Egypt, unable to wait for their bread to rise before their journey to freedom. Similarly, Catholics clean altars in churches on Maundy Thursday, ahead of Good Friday, which is held annually in the spring in March or April. Nowruz, celebrated around the vernal equinox in March, involves a tradition called shaking down the house. People wash clothes, blankets, and textiles in preparation for this approximately 3,000-year-old holiday, which can be traced back to Zoroastrianism, one of the world's first monotheistic religions. Before the Lunar New Year, it's common to cleanse the home of bad luck and misfortune in China. Known as sweeping the dust, cleaning makes way for the New Year's good luck and prosperity, says Patton. Cleaning must be done before the holiday, typically in January or February, since sweeping after the festivities is seen as removing good luck. In Thailand, during Songkran in April, it's customary to deep clean homes, schools, and public spaces to purify them ahead of the Thai New Year. People toss water at each other in the streets to wash away the previous year's bad luck, and over statues of Buddha to ensure luck for the year to come. While the concept of spring cleaning predates modern technology, advancements such as electricity and household appliances have influenced its practice. For example, before electric lights, people relied on fire from burning coal, oil, and wood to light and heat homes, which would leave behind a substantial amount of soot. Windows were kept securely closed to prevent a deadly draft from entering. Come spring, it was pragmatic to open the windows to air out stuffy homes, remove grime, and repair any damages that occurred during the winter months. Inventions such as vacuum cleaners, washing machines, and cleaning agents have made the process more efficient and convenient, allowing for deeper and more thorough cleaning of living spaces. And that completes the first article today. The title was Spring Cleaning Has Ancient Origins. Here's Why We Still Do It, by Lola Mendez. And next is an associated article with our first article. The title, This Ancient Festival is a Celebration of Springtime and a Brand New Year. Nowruz, also known as Persian New Year, has been observed for more than 3,000 years as the victory of spring over darkness, by Aaron Blakemore. For the Northern Hemisphere, March 19th is the first day of spring, but for 300 million people around the world, it's the beginning of a new year, too. Nowruz, which means new day, is a holiday marking the arrival of spring and the first day of the year in Iran, whose solar calendar begins with the vernal equinox. Nowruz has been celebrated in Iran and the Persian diaspora for more than 3,000 years. Its roots are as a feast day in Zoroastrianism, a religion practiced in ancient Persia that viewed the arrival of spring as a victory over darkness. The holiday survived the Islamic conquest of Persia in the 7th century, and the decline of Zoroastrianism's popularity, and it spread across the globe through the diaspora of Persian people throughout history. What is Nowruz and how is it celebrated? Traditionally celebrated on the vernal equinox, many begin preparations for Nowruz weeks in advance. In the lead-up to the holiday, people perform ritual dances and fill vessels in their home with water, which is associated with health, in an attempt to banish bad luck. On the last Wednesday before Nowruz, many celebrate Sharshendi Suri, a night in which they jump over fire and go to doors banging spoons to scare away bad luck. People also visit cemeteries and bring offerings for the dead, whom some believe visit before the spring rite begins. The spring festival's focus is fertility and new life, so it's appropriate that many revelers celebrate with seeds and eggs. Households set up tables covered with seven symbolic items they call haft seen. Haft means seven, and seen is S in Farsi. And all of the items start with the letter. These include seed sprouts, usually wheat, oats, and other seeds, which symbolize rebirth. Sinjed, also known as silverberry or Persian olive, which is thought to spark love. Garlic, for protection. Apple, fertility. Sumac, love. vinegar, patience, and samanu, a pudding made of sprouted wheat, affluence. The table also can include a Koran, eggs, myrrh, and poetry. Though Nowruz is old, the table tradition isn't. As A. Shapur Shabazi notes in Encyclopedia Iranica, it only came into effect in the last century. Who celebrates Nowruz? Nowruz has proven resilient in the modern era, too. After Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979, the new government attempted to suppress the festival out of fear it might detract from the state religion. But those attempts failed, and Nowruz is now celebrated as an official state holiday in Iran. It's also an official holiday in Afghanistan, Albania, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Iraqi Kurdistan, Kazakhstan, Kosovo, Kyrgyzstan, Mongolia's Bayan-Olgay province, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. And it's widely celebrated in places like Turkey, Indian, and other places with Persian enclaves. In 2009, UNESCO, the cultural arm of the United Nations, listed the holiday on its representative list of the intangible cultural heritage of humanity, noting that it promotes values of peace and solidarity between generations and within families, as well as reconciliation and neighborliness. March 21st is officially recognized as International Nowruz Day, though the holiday itself is celebrated between April 19th and 22nd, depending on calendars and vernal equinox calculations. And that completes the article. This ancient festival is a celebration of springtime and a brand new year, by Aaron Blakemore. Our next article is titled Meet the Woman Who Made Polaroid into a Cultural Icon. Murroe Marston Morse, an art history undergraduate, led and transformed the camera company into a brand beloved by photographers to this day. By David M. Beretta. Polaroid, the iconic camera, brought photography into the hands of millions beginning in the 1940s. It made anyone a photographer with the push of a button, developing the pictures right in front of your eyes. At a time when camera innovation was led almost exclusively by men, Polaroid was different in another way, too. During her relatively short time at the company, a young art history grad named Murroe Marston Morse was one of Polaroid's most important visionaries, ultimately rising to be director of the Special Photographic Research Division with 18 patents to her name. As a senior photo editor at National Geographic, I have had a lifelong love for photography. Since I was a child, I remember watching family members use Polaroids to record the mundane moments of a vacation, while I used a Nikon camera with 35mm film. But when a photographer friend later showed me how to use a toothpick to push the dyes of a Polaroid that was mid-development, resulting in a more painterly, more impressionistic final image, I became a fan. I know a fair bit about Polaroid and its founder, Edwin Land, but when I read Morse's name for the first time recently, I was intrigued to learn more about the role she played during her 2 decades there. A new kind of camera company. Morse joined Polaroid in 1945, just weeks after graduating from Smith College, having studied art history with Clarence Kennedy. A friend and associate of Edwin Land, Kennedy often recommended his best students to work at the camera company. For Land, Morse became a soulmate, a workmate, and a protector, writes Victor K. McElhenney in his biography of Edwin Land, insisting on the impossible. Morse was a natural to the Polaroid method, which McElhenney quotes one of the company's inventors as saying, was to oppose the hypothesis, to test the hypothesis, to modify the hypothesis, to test with another experiment, a sequential train moving at high speed, several hypotheses and experiments per hour. A few short months after her arrival, Morse was managing the black and white film division, where she led her team through round-the-clock shifts to transition the company away from monochromatic sepia prints to truly black and white Polaroid films. The process was full of challenges. Not only did the crystals in the darkest areas of a print become reflective, but the paper they used collected fingerprints easily. Perhaps worst of all, some of the prints would fade after a few months. Chris Bananos, whose book Instant documents the camera company's history, writes that Land called the creation of black and white film among the toughest things Polaroid ever pulled off. And Morse was at the center of it all. Former Polaroid employees John and Mary McCann told me on a recent call. Morse's team would analyze tiny incremental variances from a standard exposure, Mary said, and Morse herself had an eye for these differences, thanks to her art history training. She and Land built it from the first experiments in the lab, all the way through the $1 billion worth of film they sold, John adds. A marriage of science and art. John McCann tells me his time at Polaroid reminded him of the Renaissance, when the best scientists were the best painters, and they did everything. Artists at Polaroid were integral to science and experimentation, and their perspectives were as important as those of trained chemists. Within Morse's lab, there was a strong dedication to making technology to suit artists. She served as the liaison between scientists and the photographers who consulted for the companies, building relationships with fine art photographer Minor White, color art photography pioneer Marie Cassindis, and landscape photographer Ansel Adams. Adams was already a well-established, large-format, black-and-white photographer by the time he began to consult for Polaroid in 1948. His image, Monolith, the Face of Half Dome, Yosemite National Park, made in 1927, had landed him on the photography map. Yet Adams was very interested in Polaroid's technology, particularly the cameras and the black-and-white film that Morse was developing. The two were in nearly constant contact. Adams helped establish a process that photographers in the field used for feedback long before the advent of the digital camera. He would take a Polaroid to test the composition and exposure of an image before making a final image on the negative. Legacy. Morse died in 1969 at the age of 46, before Polaroid had expanded into a global brand and cultural touchpoint, before the toy camera craze had peaked, and long before Polaroid filed for bankruptcy in 2001. In a company-wide memo announcing her passing, Polaroid executive Richard Young wrote, "To those who knew and loved Meroyi, our lives were enriched and enlarged. Her kindness, concern, and interest in everyone were exceeded by her generosity." By the 1970s and 80s, other camera companies started to emulate Polaroid's point-and-shoot approach and aesthetic. In the late 2000s, photographers around the world went into mourning when the last Polaroid films hit their expiration dates after the company's bankruptcy. But in early 2008, as the last factories were winding down, Polaroid enthusiasts Florin Doc Caps and Andre Bossman raised over $500,000 to rescue the factories, the film, and most importantly, the chemistry knowledge of the company. And eventually, they brought Polaroid film back to market. Today, in a photography world where digital is king, the spirit that Morse and others brought to the company still lives on for photographers everywhere. That's the end of the article. The title was Meet the Woman Who Made Polaroid into a Cultural Icon by David Beretta. The last article today is titled How AI is Helping Scientists Protect Birds by Kylie Price. Each spring, scientists hide more than 1,600 lunchbox-sized recorders across the lush forests of the Sierra Nevada range in the western U.S. Until they're retrieved at summer's end, these devices record 1,000,000 hours of audio, which often contains the hoots, barks, and whistles of the California spotted owl, valuable information about where the endangered species spends its time. But it's a lot of recordings for a human to sift through. There's no way we can listen to that, not even close, right? Says Connor Wood, a research associate who leads the OWL project at the K. Lisa Yang Center for Conservation Bioacoustics, part of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. It turns out this team actually can process this deluge of data. They just need a little help from BirdNet, an AI-powered system launched in 2018 that can identify more than 6,000 species of birds across the globe just by their calls. We need tools that are really flexible and capable of identifying as many acoustically active animals as possible, says Wood, whose lab developed BirdNet with the Chemnitz University of Technology in Germany. I really can't overstate how transformative the app is for the field of bioacoustics. Over the past decade, several apps have popped up that tap into the power of artificial intelligence to identify different avian sounds, which are used by scientists and birders alike. These tools have their faults. They can sometimes misidentify species, for instance. But more research is showing that AI can identify bird behaviors and distribution, which is critical for conservation. How does it work? In 2016, Cornell approached Stefan Kahl, a computer scientist at Chemnitz University of Technology, to help create an algorithm that processes bird sounds recorded in the wild. 2 years later, the team launched the official BirdNet app, which allows people across the world to upload their own recordings from a variety of devices, including laptops and smartphones. Since then, BirdNet has amassed roughly 150 million high-quality bird sounds. Adding to this trove of data, Cornell's other A1 AI-powered avian acoustic app, Merlin, has more than 3 million active users, feeding acoustic data into the system. But how do these seemingly magical tools work? The app converts a bird's song into an image of sound waves, known as a spectrogram. Then the image is fed into the app's algorithm, which can pinpoint the unique frequency changes, timing, and amplitude of a particular call. These patterns that the algorithms find are much more subtle and fine-grained than what any human could do, says Kahl, who also works as a postdoctoral researcher at the Cornell Lab's Conservation Bioacoustics Center. With funding from the U.S. Forest Service and National Park Service, Wood and his teams recently used BirdNet to create the first ecosystem-wide assessment of spotted owl populations across the Sierra Nevada, which increasingly face threats from invasive species or wildfires. This information shows owl population trends that can boost restoration and conservation efforts, he says. Agencies are not just buying into this as a monitoring tool for telling them about populations, but to really specifically facilitate on-the-ground action, which is pretty exciting, Woods says. Downsides to AI. However, like most AI-based technology, these apps are not without pitfalls. In his 2023 study in the International Journal of Avian Science, ecologist Christian Perez Granados reviewed a range of scientific literature on BirdNet. His research found that BirdNet didn't always register a bird's song and sometimes misidentified it as another species, which results in false positives. Merlin users have also reported cases of misidentification, which could have negative implication for research projects that incorporate citizen science data, according to the Audubon Society and other organizations. BirdNet and some other software have made a great difference in the last 2 or 3 years, but they need to continue growing and improving, Perez Granados says. And with that, we have run out of time. The article's title was How AI is Helping Scientists Protect Birds by Kylie Price. This has been the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by SunSounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. The articles I've read today were all published in March of 2024 by the Geographic Society. I hope you found the program interesting and informative. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to SunSounds of Arizona with its premium programming. And if you missed a program that you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, and then click on demand. Here you'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.